No veto this time. A resolution gets passed at the UN calling for a ceasefire in Gaza and the release of all Israeli hostages. But the U.S. abstains.
What was missing was a condemnation of Hamas's initial attack. And that's the reason that the United States abstained.
I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Moscow has thousands of police, but when gunmen attacked a crowded theater on Friday night, there was no security on the scene.
The response from the Russian security services was very, very weak.
Also, good news from Nigeria, where kidnapped school kids go free.
And a country singer moving beyond the genre's stereotypes.
It's about pickup trucks and drinking. And when people see me, it doesn't look like that.
All that and more today here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Thank you for joining us today. For the first time since the start of the war between Israel and Hamas last October, the United Nations Security Council has passed a resolution calling for an immediate ceasefire. It also calls for the unconditional release of all hostages still being held in Gaza and for more humanitarian aid for the Palestinian population there.
The United States abstained from today's vote in the Security Council. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield explained why.
We did not agree with everything in the resolution. For that reason, we were unfortunately not able to vote yes. However, as I've said before, we fully support some of the critical objectives in this non-binding resolution.
Thomas Greenfield said the U.S. wanted to include a condemnation of Hamas in the U.N. resolution, but it was left out of the final text. In response to today's vote, Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu canceled a planned trip by senior advisors to the U.S. for later this week. For more on how this news is reverberating in Israel, we reached out to reporter Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem. She explained that the U.N. resolution calls for a two-week ceasefire that would last through the end of the Muslim holy month of Ramadan.
It doesn't matter in terms of anything on the ground. It matters symbolically, I'd say, because it is the first overt U.S. opposition to something that Israel was expecting from it or requested from it. But this follows many weeks now of the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu being overtly defiant and even, I'd say, insulting towards President Biden.
So how is this news from the UN going over with people in Israel, both the public and officials?
The Prime Minister's office immediately released a statement, a very, very angry and kind of roiling statement within minutes of this vote. And it's a strange statement, not only because of its overt fury, but because it clearly misrepresents the text of the resolution. Hmm. In this statement, Netanyahu says that he is canceling the trip of his two senior advisors to Washington because the resolution is not conditioned on the release of Israeli hostages. And the resolution actually does call for the simultaneous ceasefire and release of hostages.
So what's your interpretation of why Netanyahu is taking the step of canceling this planned trip by two of his top advisors to the U.S.? Is that more signaling?
Netanyahu is in an extremely difficult spot right now. And basically, personal interests as a politician and as a criminal defendant on trial for corruption charges are right now in stark opposition to what are the evident interests of the state of Israel, which is to hew very close to its top ally, the United States. Netanyahu has very little support in Israel right now. Polls show him somewhere under 20% or around there. And he has a very fractious coalition. So his interest is to try and portray the United States as a rival that he can stand up to. Whether Israelis will buy it or not is a very big question. In the past, 9-10 years ago, Israelis did take this premise. Today, Joe Biden is one of the most popular figures in Israel. So it's a big gamble on his part.
Hmm. Is what happened today a serious rupture between the U.S. and Israel, or just, you know, another incremental step?
Well, according to the White House, it's not. They issued also an immediate statement saying that they haven't changed policy, they haven't shifted. And so what we're seeing is a White House that's trying to tell Israelis, we're with you, but at the same time, telling Netanyahu, you're not acting like an ally. And that's a tricky maneuver, and it's a nuanced maneuver in an era in which we see very little nuances in international politics. So this, too, is a gamble.
So the top advisors that Netanyahu has called back from a trip to Washington, D.C., what were they going to talk about with leaders here in D.C.?
In their last conversation, President Biden explicitly asked Prime Minister Netanyahu to send a delegation to Washington to discuss alternatives to a move that Netanyahu keeps promising and that the White House opposes, which is a ground invasion of the southern Gazan city of Rafah. But Netanyahu has been claiming this since February at some point, and the Israeli army has not made any preparatives for a massive ground invasion. It hasn't called up soldiers. It's not preparing anything. So it's hard to know even if that promise slash threat is public posturing or it's real. But the United States is acting as if it's real and asked Netanyahu for a delegation to hear alternative possibilities. So not sending this delegation is absolutely a slap in the face to the president. That said, Mr. Netanyahu's defense minister, Yoav Gallant, who is also a kind of rival of his, is in Washington today. He went on his own autonomous trip to discuss Israel's military with Secretary Austin. And so the White House simply said today that, okay, they're disappointed the delegation isn't coming, but they'll discuss Rafah with the defense minister.
Is the U.S. signaling that going forward, Israel cannot take U.S. military support for granted?
100%. And this was made explicit by Vice President Harris in a Sunday interview in which she was asked if there could be consequences for Israel basically defying the United States in its military operations. And she said everything is on the table. The fact that that is even being considered by the U.S. government in a situation in which Israel was attacked in a catastrophic terror attack by an Islamist terror group. The fact that Israel has gotten itself into a position, which is really, I believe, unprecedented in the history of relations between the two states, where the United States is seriously considering stopping the transfer of arms to a country that is a close ally. This has to be considered a failing grade for the Israeli government.
Back to the big picture here. This war began almost 6 months ago, and only now the UN Security Council passes a ceasefire resolution. You've already mentioned it's not likely to change anything on the ground. How much influence does the international community have right now to bring this war to an end?
Only the United States has that kind of influence. I don't think the international community does. And specifically, I'd mention the United Nations as the representative of kind of international agencies and stakeholders in Gaza, who in their own way have also lost a lot of credibility during this period and don't have really any leverage, I would say, either over the United States or over Israel right now.
Journalist Noga Tarnopolsky spoke with us from Jerusalem. Last night, Jews around the world celebrated Purim. It's known in Israel for being a raucous holiday, celebrated with costumes, sweets, and for those who are old enough, lots of drinking. But the ongoing war makes things much more complicated for Israelis. Sarah Ventry reports from Jerusalem.
In Judaism, the story of Purim is a classic tale of good defeating evil with the help of God. The basic story is that in ancient Persia, one of the king's most powerful officials, Haman, wanted to kill all the Jews. But the king didn't know that his newly chosen queen Esther was actually Jewish. So when she found out about Haman's plot, she worked out a plan to trap him. And it worked. Haman was executed, and the Jews were spared.
Parties, masks, drinking, the reading of the scroll of Esther at night and in the morning, and a Purim Suda, a Purim feast. That is what is done in a regular year.
This is Rabbi David Galinkin. He's the president of the Schechter Institutes Incorporated, an organization that supports a number of Jewish schools, mostly in Israel.
In this particular year, our joy is limited or is held back by the fact that there are still 134 Israeli hostages in Gaza, by the fact that we have many soldiers fighting in Gaza and on the northern border, and by the fact that there are hundreds of thousands of Israelis who have been displaced from their homes.
Rabbi Galinkin says that this year, Purim hits different.
Unfortunately, there are many parallels between Hamas and Haman in the Purim story. Haman wanted to destroy the entire Jewish people, and that's exactly what Hamas wants to do.
Rabbi Galinkin isn't unique in this view. The Times of Israel reported that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu celebrated Purim with troops and said, "We eliminated Haman and we will eliminate Sinwar," referring to Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas. Families from two different congregations gathered together in the gym of a Jerusalem school to hear the reading of the Megillah, which tells the story of Purim. And whenever Haman's name is read, it's drowned out with noisemakers and booing. You can even hear some electric bass being played at this less traditional congregation. Even though not everyone was sure it was appropriate this year, both kids and adults dressed up in costume. In Jerusalem's market, known as the Shuk, 20 and 30-somethings came out last night in full force. In Jewish text, there is a saying that on Purim, one should get so drunk that they can't tell the difference between the hero and villain of the story. And these partygoers seem to take this very seriously. Though the party at the Shuk has always been a young person's game, there did seem to be something of a generational divide this year in the way people saw the holiday. Most of the people I talked to over the age of 40 were a bit more ambivalent. They seemed to want to celebrate and find joy, but it was overshadowed by sadness and grief. Many of the young people I saw were ready for this chance to be out. People dressed as fairies and unicorns, soldiers and police officers, all roamed the streets of the closed-off Shuk. There were also a number of people dressed as Arabs. And more than once, I saw people gathered together, dancing and singing, "May your village burn," a chant meant to specifically reference Palestinian Arab villages. While those 20-somethings were getting dressed and ready to go out, on the other side of town, Rabbi Ezra Endy and dozens of families were gathered in that school gym, having fun of their own. Little kids roamed around, snacking on sweets and playing with colorful noisemakers. Still,
this year, celebrating Purim was a challenge. It was very important for us to continue on living our Jewish lives in Jewish rhythm, because Purim is a way for us to express many emotions that we have.
Rabbi Endy decided to include one extra prayer in his Purim service, called Oseh Shalom, a prayer for peace. It translates to, "May the one who makes peace in the high heavens make peace for us and to all Israel." And after they sang it, they added one extra phrase, "V'al kol b'nei Adam," and on all the children of Adam. For the world, I'm Sarah Ventry in Jerusalem.
An update for you now on Senegal's presidential election, where the opposition candidate is expected to win. The contest between Bassirou Diomaye Faye and a former prime minister appeared to conclude today, with the former PM congratulating Faye and wishing him success. The lead-up to Senegal's election had been marred with accusations that the outgoing president was trying to extend his term in office unconstitutionally.
And more leadership news now from the Republic of Ireland. The country will likely get its youngest ever prime minister, with 37-year-old Simon Harris. He emerged this weekend as the top choice from the Fine Gael party. That sets up Harris to be formally elected when the Irish parliament returns from its Easter break. The opening was created when Leo Varadkar announced his surprise resignation last week.
Coming up, killer whales. The discovery of a new group of orcas is expanding our understanding of the ocean's apex predators. That's next. You're listening to The World.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Killer whales are easily recognizable in the world's oceans, but researchers in the U.S. and Canada think they may have identified a population of orcas that no one knew about. Andrew Treitz is a professor at the University of British Columbia.
Well, it was one of my graduate students, Josh McGinnis, who made the discovery. Josh had been engaged in putting together a catalog of known killer whales off the coast of California and Oregon. The way we identify killer whales is from photographs, and Josh was able to match up all these whales in California, Oregon, except for 49 individuals. And as Josh began wondering, like, who could they be? it dawned on him, and he managed to convince all the rest of us that, in fact, these probably all fit together, and they are a unique group.
And so to back up just a little bit, there was previous to this research three populations that had been identified, those that live, that kind of hug the coast, those that live farther offshore, and those that are transient. And so what set these apart in terms of their movement?
So there are indeed three recognized populations. We call them ecotypes because they have unique diets and behaviors. One group only eats fish, and we call those the resident killer whales. The other one eats only marine mammals, and we call them transient or Biggs killer whales. And the third group, we call them the offshores, and they seem to be specializing in eating sharks and large fish. So this would be a fourth group, which is further offshore again, which we're calling the oceanics. And I guess one thing that's differentiating them is perhaps that they're specializing in consuming marine mammals and species that live far, far, far from land in the open ocean. For example, one of the prey are sperm whales. And sperm whales have, we had one encounter where the sperm whales, there were nine adult female sperm whales. And when they came under attack, they formed a rosetta where they all put their heads into the center of the circle, tails out to try to defend themselves. But it took this coordinated attack from 12 killer whales to bring down one of them.
I guess I'm surprised that scientists have a good enough grasp on existing populations and even existing individuals to notice when new whales pop up. Is there a good sense of sort of all of the individual orca whales that are out there based on their fin appearance in photos?
You know, it's taken time to figure out even what we do know today. If we go back to the 60s and early 70s, when killer whales being captured mostly here off the coast of British Columbia and Washington state, they're being sent off to aquariums. And people thought at that time that there was just one type of whale called a killer whale, and there were thousands of them. But over the years, it became apparent that, no, there were three unique populations with distinct diets, distinct behaviors, travel patterns. And as we begin to pay more attention, we begin to learn things that escaped everybody's view for tens to hundreds to probably thousands of years.
Can you tell me more about these cookie cutter shark marks that you found on killer whales? What does that tell you about where they travel?
This is a species of shark which doesn't kill its prey. It just feeds off it. And it's more almost like a parasite, perhaps. But this is a shark that's restricted to warm tropical waters. So that's telling us that these killer whales have spent time, if not considerable time, in warmer waters further south. But at the same time, we're seeing them further north in colder waters. So we just don't know how far north they may go ultimately, nor do we know their seasonal movements. In fact, there's so much we still have to discover about them.
Andrew Treitz is a professor at the University of British Columbia. He's one of the researchers who wrote about the discovery of what looks like a new population of killer whales.
New sections of wall are replacing the border wall that separated San Diego and Tijuana for years. The Tijuana side of that barrier is decorated with vivid painted murals. And as the new wall goes up, efforts are underway to save some of that artwork. KPBS border reporter Gustavo Solis has more.
For a long time, the border wall was just that, a wall. Then, artists on the Mexican side decided to make it a window into our cross-border culture. They painted colorful, vibrant murals, a blood-red heart with love written on it, a depiction of President Joe Biden making out with Donald Trump, and powerful tributes to deported veterans. Maria Teresa Fernandez is a photographer who chronicled this transformation for 25 years.
And since I started, I started kind of feeling that that object, the wall, was alive.
Then came 2023. That's when the U.S. government tore down the old wall so it could build a bigger one. And the window was shattered, or so we thought.
We knew the Mexico side, the community on the Mexico side had invested so much love and care and energy and creativity in this site. We wanted to make sure that some of that was preserved.
That's John Fanestill, an activist with the group Friends of Friendship Park. He couldn't bear to see those murals lost forever. So he called Micah Parson, CEO of the Museum of Us, with one simple question.
Would you consider having the museum try to obtain these sections of the wall before they get destroyed? And we absolutely jumped at the opportunity.
It has taken 8 months for the museum to acquire 20 pieces of the old border wall. Each section weighs more than 4,000 pounds. Parsons says it was a very complicated process. But those 20 pieces are now safe in an undisclosed location in the South Bay. Fernandez, the photographer, is overjoyed to see the murals survive.
They mean a lot. They mean a lot for the history of that area.
Parsons says this part of history won't be locked up in a museum.
They don't belong to us. They really belong to the community. And it's the community that should come together to decide how this sort of wealth gets redistributed back into our trinational region.
Museums have a history of taking things that don't belong to them. Parson sees this project as part of an ongoing effort to correct the mistakes of the past.
Since our inception, we have caused inestimable harm to indigenous communities, to other communities of color, by taking their belongings, by taking their ancestors and refusing to give them back for decades. And we've really, over the last several years, turned that corner and realized they don't belong to us as an institution.
Fannin Steele says Friends of Friendship Park, the Museum of Us, and other community stakeholders will spend the next year figuring out where and how to display these unique artifacts.
Perhaps there will be sites in the public, either on either side of the border. Perhaps there might be a traveling site with a section or two of the wall able to visit different locations. We don't know. These are all possibilities.
They envision a truly genuine tri-national effort involving people from San Diego, Tijuana, and Kumeyaay Nation. Brandon Linton is a cultural consultant and member of the Kumeyaay.
Right, before there was a U.S.-Mexico, there was us, the Kumeyaay people. And so we originally inhabited the area from generally down around the Ensenada area up to Capistrano area.
And Friendship Park is right in the middle of that area.
And so the U.S.-Mexico border, from its conception, split our homeland virtually in half.
Linton says the border wall has had a devastating impact on the Kumeyaay people. It has kept them separated for generations.
This project is a great way to bring attention to that and bring some light to those issues of people that need to move back and forth across that border.
The group plans to create a community advisory council that will decide what to do with the murals. They also plan to hold several community meetings throughout the process. For The World, I'm Gustavo Solis in San Diego.
It's The World.
The British Armed Forces are falling behind at signing up new recruits.
The Navy and the Air Force are failing to meet targets that were set a few years ago. And it's just this continued net loss, which is showing no signs of going away, which is really problematic.
Especially because NATO member countries are trying to expand their militaries in the face of new threats. That story ahead here on The World.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Thank you for joining us. Today in Russia, people are mourning the victims of Friday's deadly attack on a concert hall on the outskirts of Moscow. Russian officials say nearly 140 people were killed in that attack. At least 180 more were injured.
Four suspects are in custody. They've been charged with committing an act of terrorism. We are still without answers to many key questions around this attack. The Kremlin has already been crafting a narrative that could have major security implications for Russians and their neighbors in Ukraine. The World's Daniel Hoffman reports from Riga, Latvia.
In Moscow, billboards and street signs all around the city say, "We mourn." Across the country, flags are at half-mast. And over the weekend, at the Krokus City Hall concert venue, people lined up to lay flowers and light memorial candles. Russian President Vladimir Putin took a day before addressing the nation. Putin said that this was a bloody, barbaric act of terrorism. He said that the four gunmen who allegedly executed the attack were taken into custody. Putin didn't directly say who's responsible for the attack, but he did make some strong insinuations.
Они пытались скрыться и двигались в сторону Украины.
He said the gunmen tried to get away and were moving towards Ukraine. he added that a window for crossing the border was prepared for them by the Ukrainian side. But he didn't present any evidence. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky called out Putin.
Putin, замість того, щоб займатися своїми громадянами Росії, звертатись до них, добу мовчав.
He said that instead of addressing Russian citizens, he was silent for a day, thinking about how to blame Ukraine. According to numerous reports, ISIS-K, an affiliate of ISIS, has taken responsibility for the attack. The group shared a photo of the four alleged gunmen, as well as a video filmed by one of the attackers during the shooting. U.S. officials have also attributed the attack to ISIS. But Putin made no mention of ISIS during his speech, and the narrative blaming Ukraine has taken on a life of its own on Russian state TV. They're echoing Putin's message that the terrorists were making their way towards Ukraine after the attack. Weeks before the mass shooting, the U.S. Embassy in Moscow issued a security alert warning that extremists had imminent plans to target large gatherings in Moscow. But Putin dismissed them as just provocative statements.
Все это напоминает откровенный шантаж и намерение запугать, дестабилизировать наше общество.
3 days before the attack, Putin called the warnings blackmail with the intention to intimidate and destabilize Russian society.
The political reasons were put above intelligence and above people's lives.
Irina Borogan is an expert on Russia's security services with the Center for European Policy Analysis. She says that Russian security agencies like the FSB and regular police had access to information, but they didn't act on it.
If I am an FSB officer or I am a police officer, I can't come to my superior and say, we have to pay attention to this because this is an authoritarian country. And my president said that this is all disinformation and provocative information from the Americans.
And as a result of that political thinking, Borogan says the response was inadequate.
The response from the Russian security services was very, very weak. Moscow is a region which has a huge security forces presence. Only Moscow police, it's around 100,000 people. But no one appeared on the crime scene, at least at the moment when the gunman had been shooting people.
Borogan says that another security failure was that the gunmen were able to get away. They were finally caught about 200 miles southwest of Moscow. She says finding an easy scapegoat like Ukraine helps distract from the Kremlin's mistakes.
Russia is involved with Ukraine, and population needs some simple explanation. And Ukraine, it sounds very plausible for people who are supportive of the war.
Of course, not all Russians support the war in Ukraine, so blaming Ukraine doesn't work as an explanation for everyone. Borogan says that Russian security services have tried to signal their strength by allowing videos to circulate showing the alleged gunmen bloodied and tortured.
We saw tortures by the Russian security services many times before, but usually they don't want to demonstrate what happened. But these days, that's not the same. To me, it's an attempt to distract their attention from what happened, from the security services, to revenge.
When it comes to revenge, the reaction from the Kremlin will likely be harsh, but not just towards the assailants. Russia is already a highly repressive security state. Borogan will be watching how much further Putin could go. For The World, I'm Daniel Hoffman, Riga, Latvia.
In northern Nigeria, as you may recall, nearly 300 school children were kidnapped from school a couple of weeks ago. Today, many of them are free. One of the parents spoke with local news and had only one word to describe how people are feeling.
Jubilation, in fact. Jubilation all over the village. Jubilation.
Jubilation now. Gunmen on motorcycles had snatched the children from school in the early morning. The school says 287 kids were abducted. The kidnappers demanded a ransom, but Nigeria's president refused to pay up. Not a dime, he was quoted as saying. This weekend, though, Nigeria's military recovered 137 children, grubby and tired, but alive. Philip Obaji Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Beast in Abuja, Nigeria.
The government itself never really quoted a number, you know, of school children who were kidnapped. But school teachers in the secondary and primary school where this incident took place did quote the number 287. It's very difficult to confirm because Kuriga, the town where the school is located, doesn't have telephone or internet network currently as we speak. So it's really, really, really very hard. But the government is saying that only 137 school children were kidnapped. And that's the number that returned yesterday.
So are any parents saying their children are not back?
So far, no, we haven't heard from any parent yet. But the situation will become clear in the coming days.
What details can you give us about how the school kids were rescued, Philip?
Well, it's still not clear as to exactly what transpired between the security forces and the bandits who kidnapped the school children. So we were told by the governor of Kaduna State, where the school children were kidnapped from, quote, unquote, a special security operation embarked upon by the military led to the rescue of the school children. But that doesn't seem to be the case. And some of my contacts in the Nigerian armed forces said there was negotiation between, you know, the military and the bandits. Unfortunately, a school teacher died in captivity. We don't have much details as to what led to the death of the school teacher. But yes, it's good news to families. And in the past, we see a situation where school kids are abducted and they remain in captivity for so long.
Is anything known about the kidnappers and their whereabouts at this point?
The identity so far has not been revealed to anyone. It's not been reported yet who these kidnappers are. We're not sure that the government will ever tell us exactly who they are or who they were. So, yeah.
Philip, when we last spoke, we talked about how the state in Nigeria is really looking more fragile than it has in a long time. There's also concern among Nigerians about what level of security their government actually provides them, especially when we see mass abductions like this. Does this rescue change anything?
Well, I don't think so. I'll be surprised if anything changes. Remember in 2014 when, you know, schoolgirls were kidnapped in Chibok, many people thought that that would be an eye-opener and that there will be adequate security provided to school children across the country. But that didn't happen despite the huge international outcry for the release of the Chibok schoolgirls and their kind of attention that the kidnappings actually gained. But we're seeing, you know, more and more abductions happening in the north of Nigeria. But it doesn't seem like we've seen the last of this. You know, it's so difficult for you to have security personnel man the gates of the hundreds of thousands of primary and secondary schools that are available in Nigeria. So sad to say this, but, you know, I don't think that we've seen the last of this.
Well, we heard from one of the kidnapped kids' parents earlier in the sense of jubilation in northwest Nigeria. How are people in the rest of the country reacting to the latest news of these freed kids?
Well, people are actually jubilant and people are happy that these school kids have been rescued. You go to social media, people are tweeting and expressing their appreciation to the Nigerian government on the quick release of these school children. In the past, we see a situation where school kids are abducted and they remain in captivity for so long. Sometimes, you know, nothing is even heard about them afterwards.
In this whole story, Philip, what questions do you still want answered?
Okay, questions weren't answered. Well, I think that it's important for us to know exactly, you know, who these bandits are. It is possible that the bandits are armed, are even well-armed to continue kidnappings and other criminal acts. So it will be interesting for the government to tell us exactly how these kids were rescued.
Philip Obagi Jr. is a correspondent for The Daily Beast based in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. Europe is facing its biggest security threat since World War II. That warning is from the European Council President, Charles Michel. He told EU leaders last week that in order to maintain peace, they need to prepare for war. There is one immediate problem, though, as the world's Europe correspondent, Orla Barry, reports.
In a new TV ad for the British Army, soldiers are guiding groups of terrified people towards a helicopter. There's black smoke billowing in a field behind them.
What's your gut saying? Do nothing? Or help?
What's your gut saying, the voiceover says. Do nothing or help. Many of the civilians are elderly and they're all white. It looks like an evacuation from a town somewhere in England. The ad is trying to attract people who would never consider a career in the military. And it's very different from how British Army recruitment ads used to look.
For the action, for excitement, for adventure. Under pressure, under fire, under any circumstances.
Usually, soldiers would be seen running from gunfire or leaping out of helicopters into what looks like a war zone. But the army has changed its recruitment tactics. And there's a good reason for that.
Both the Navy and the Air Force are failing to meet targets that were set a few years ago. And it's just this continued net loss, which is showing no signs of going away, which is really problematic.
Sophie Antrobus is a military veteran and a research associate with the School of Security Studies at King's College in London. She joined the Royal Air Force in 1991, she says, really for just one reason.
I'll be completely honest with you. I wanted to fly aircraft. I'd have joined any force anywhere, I think, if they'd taken me to fly.
Antrobus went on to do tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan. She says research shows that young people are more likely to sign up if their country is directly involved in a conflict.
Having spent several years in specifically Iraq and Afghanistan, there isn't a hot war as such going on. And we do find that young people are less attracted to the military when there isn't a particular focus on a particular operation.
But there are lots of other reasons why people are unwilling to join the armed forces in the UK. Unlike previous generations, many young people no longer know family members who've served in the military. Antrobus says the recruitment process is also painfully slow. Figures released in the UK last week show 3/4 of would-be recruits drop out because the application process takes so long. And the involvement of British forces in some recent overseas operations may not help matters either.
For the UK, both Iraq and Afghanistan were defeats and pretty much disasters. There's been huge levels of public criticism of the armed forces.
Anthony King is director of the Strategy and Security Institute at Exeter University. He says troop numbers have plummeted across Europe since the end of the Cold War. EU leaders have been reluctant to invest in defence for decades, he says, much to the irritation of lawmakers across the Atlantic.
American politicians since the end of the Cold War have been complaining about Europe free riding on American defence really quite profoundly.
That lack of investment affects those already serving too. Poor salaries and substandard living conditions have driven many to jobs in the private sector, King says. In Germany, the lack of investment in defence has become all the more noticeable since Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Und sie hat seit dem 24. Februar 2022 noch weniger.
Eva Hügel, a parliamentary commissioner in Berlin, said that since the 24th of February 2022, her country's forces had too little of everything, from training to equipment. Some EU member states are trying to improve matters. In Poland, the government is increasing soldiers' salaries by 20%. France is proposing better wages and pensions for its armed forces. And across Europe, there are debates about whether mandatory military service needs to be introduced. Earlier this month, Denmark announced plans to extend conscription to women. Karen Philippa Larsen, who joined the Danish military in 2014, says she welcomes that news, but...
I also see a need to work with the culture and the armed forces in Denmark in order to make sure that women are treated properly and to ensure their well-being while they're there.
Larsen is chairperson of the Danish Association of Female Veterans. Her organisation has identified more than 200 reports of sexual abuse and offensive behaviour in the last few years. But Larsen says many of the women who report abuse end up leaving the forces shortly afterwards.
It's extremely vulnerable to actually go ahead and say something in the armed forces. And what we are hearing now is that they experience sort of a social backlash when they talk about these things. They feel sort of socially excluded from the group all of a sudden.
If European armies are serious about expanding their numbers, she says, they need to tackle the sexism and harassment that's still prevalent. Defence expert Anthony King says conscription is still unlikely in many European countries. But he says that means governments will have to invest in their professional armies.
Every other part of the world has increased defence spending very significantly over the last 10, 15 years. Europe is entirely on its own in having reduced it.
For years, Europe enjoyed the privileged position of being at peace, King says. But with the Russian invasion, that's no longer the case. And European leaders may soon need to make some unpopular decisions and raise their military spending by a whole lot more. For the world, I'm Orla Barry.
Country music has its own stereotypes. Country also has some artists challenging those tropes. Plus, a British woman makes history in one of long-distance running's hardest and weirdest races. That's just ahead. You're listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler.
Recently, a country music act from Toronto caught my eye, or more accurately, caught my ear. This song especially.
Go ahead and tell me what this is all about.
Oh, Marco, this is road trip music for me. I can tell she's about to tell me a story. Who is this?
This is Nicolette and the Nobodies from Ontario. Nicolette Huang is the lead singer. I got a chance to meet her a couple of weeks ago and hear more about her story and this number called Show Up.
Not knowing is torture. A weight I cannot bear.
This is such a beautiful and poignant song. Nicolette, tell me more.
Show Up. I wrote that song about a friend who was in a not great relationship, and sometimes you wish a friend would leave. But I really started thinking about, you know, why you wouldn't, and that I've been there before. So I started writing Show Up about how I would feel in that situation.
There is this stereotype in country lyrics, as you know, that's almost comical sometimes. You're dealing with something that is much more heartfelt. On the other hand, you have this rousing rock and country tune called Rodeo. How do you think about country music? Is it about rethinking it or kind of playing with the genre?
Sometimes it's playing with the genre. I find that at least the country music that I'm very drawn to is very emotional and direct. And there is a part of it that I like to call a bit of puzzling, which is, you know, there's a lot of themes that you can play off of. But in order for it to be genuine, it also has to have genuine feelings.
It's just cruel how quickly you can carry on.
Your entry into this world of country music does not feel calculated. I know you didn't ever think, I'm going to be the next Shania Twain. What did you listen to growing up?
I definitely did not listen to that much country music. And it took a while for me to get there. But I did actually listen to Shania Twain and Celine Dion and Elton John, Pink Floyd. I'm thinking of like going through my parents' records.
Yeah, I know your parents emigrated from Vietnam. So was there kind of a before and after kind of collection of music that they listened to?
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I also grew up with a lot of Vietnamese music around me, but they don't really speak too much about the music they listened to back home. I mean, my mom is a huge fan of Francois Hardy, so I also listened to that when I was
the French singer,
too.
Yeah.
Yeah, which makes sense because like French language is like the second language in Vietnam.
So how did you get into country? What was the starting point there?
I was going through my parents' records and I found a Tammy Wynette record, like a best of, and a Glen Campbell record. When I put on that, like, I mean, specifically the Tammy Wynette, I was like, this is so good. This resonates for me. This draws me. I liked the drama.
Yeah.
With Tammy Wynette. I mean, she's got a natural cry in her voice. And when she hits those big notes, there's strain and you can feel that emotional tension. And of course, after that, I found Loretta Lynn, George Jones, Ernest Tubb. So I became a very big country music fan.
You've been quoted as saying, I had never envisioned myself in country. Why would I?
No.
I had never seen anyone who looks like me in that world, but now that I've found my voice, I want to see what it has to say. What has been the reaction in clubs and venues when people in the audience don't know anything about Nicolette and the Nobodies?
I mean, there's a bit of surprise. I often hear people saying the same thing, which is that they didn't know they liked country music, but they liked this.
What do you think that's about?
There's definitely a stereotype to country music. It's a very white, male-dominated genre. It's about pickup trucks and drinking. And when people see me, it doesn't look like that.
The Long Way, your debut album, is out in April. And I see you'll be playing some dates in the Northeast U.S. in May. When are you going to take Nashville?
I'm hoping shortly after.
Yeah, they need to hear
that
you.
That's the plan. I hope to get to Nashville soon. These are my first dates in the, well, like my first tour in the U.S. because we've only played mostly Canada. So I'm excited to explore more. I'm excited to play places we've never played. And Nashville's definitely on the docket.
Vietnamese-Canadian country singer Nicolette Hoang of Nicolette and the Nobodies. And since we spoke, that date in Nashville is booked. They'll be playing in Music City on May 16th.
There is a race so grueling that in most years, no one even finishes it. It's the infamous Barkley Marathons in rural Tennessee. Yes, marathons, because the race covers 130 miles and 63,000 feet of elevation in five loops of rugged mountain terrain that have to be completed without the aid of GPS. Runners have less than 60 hours to do it. And this year, five participants actually finished the challenge. Two Americans, along with a Ukrainian, a New Zealander, and, for the first time ever, a woman reached the finish of the Barkley Marathons. Jasmine Paris from the United Kingdom.
Oh my God.
You can see a photo of her finish on the internet with just 99 seconds left on the 60-hour clock. Paris hurled herself at the yellow metal gate that serves as the finish line, slumping to the ground, spit flying in utter triumph. Her voice was hoarse after 2.5 days of hard running. Paris talked with the podcast Singletrack at the finish line.
I couldn't believe I was still going. It was like everything was screaming for oxygen. And I was just making it go harder and harder. And then I guess I thought, I'll either pass out or I'll finish.
This is a race well known for its idiosyncrasies. The entry fee is $1.60 plus an application letter. The start time is unknown to everyone until the last minute when a conch shell is blown. And to prove they've actually covered the full terrain of the race, runners tear pages from books that are left along the course route.
I'm exhausted just thinking about it. The World is a co-production of GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. Join us right back here tomorrow.
From PRX.